That is a hard verse to read. I got you, man. Let's slide that in. I tried to get him to say pickle instead of fickle, but he was on it. Listen, today is the final day of a series we've been doing on the names of God in the Old Testament. And we've seen that each one of those names means something important, something distinct. Now, I think we lose a little bit of the importance, actually, in our culture because names do something different today than they did for these folks back then. Today, we use a name really to differentiate between one person or another. We give someone a name so that you can tell them apart, so you don't have to use a pronoun all the time. So someone's named Nate or Tom or Sarah, etc. And they differentiate between people. But in the ancient world, when the Bible gives a person a name, or when people ascribe a name to God, it is serious business. In the ancient world, a name doesn't just distinguish one person from another. What a name does is tell something essential about the nature of that person. Now, most of the time, and I'll leave a few times, most of the time, people I know at least, they pick names from a baby book, or maybe they're walking through a Pottery Barn and see a color they like, and they're like, that seems like a great name. But, you know who I'm talking about. But we rarely prophesy a name based on someone's character. So for instance, my name in Greek, Jason, means something supposedly, at least this is the souvenir bookmark I got one day. It says healer. My parents did not think, at least I hope they didn't, that I would be a medical doctor. I've severely failed them, if that's the case, and that I would go about healing people. That wasn't what they thought on the day of my birth. They thought that we were in New York and no one was named Jason there. Of course, they moved back to the Midwest and everyone my age is named Jason, but that's another thing. So their idea of differentiating me from someone else didn't really work. But in the ancient culture, a name served to capture or embody the essence of the person being named. It says something profound about their nature. Over the last few weeks, we've learned about how faithful men and women in the Bible called upon God by different names, like Jehovah Rapha, El Shaddai, El Roi. And last week, Pastor Rollin talked to us about God as Adonai, the ruler of everything. Today, we're going to look at one final name for God in the Hebrew Bible, and that name is El Olam. And El Olam means everlasting God. Now, in the story Sam just read, Abraham and a king named Abimelech, which coincidentally sounds like the beginning of that song, In the Jungle, Abimelech, Abimelech. All week it was in my head, I couldn't get it out, but now you won't either. You can thank me for that. Abimelech makes a treaty with Abraham, and it allows Abraham to have a permanent well in his new country, the area around Beersheba. Abraham then worships God and uses a name that hasn't been used up to this point in the Bible, El Olam, the everlasting God. Honestly, this story is a bit weird. In fact, Sam asked me, what am I going to preach on? He had been reading this which part, how do you get around this? Like, where's the meat here? And actually, it's such a really interesting and on the surface, kind of a weird passage to choose to preach on. But let me get after this. There's actually a ton going on here, even though the meaning isn't abundantly clear. There are lambs and cows and wells and Philistines. We'll put that all aside for a minute, and let's get down to the depth of things. So we're going to spend our time today getting to the bottom of this story. Now, by the time we close, my hope is that you'll be able to answer three questions. Okay? The first question is, what is going on in this story? Okay, and you can tell people at the Mexican place about this story if you want, but you'll be able to tell them. Question two, what does all this have to do with El Olam, the everlasting God, the name El Olam? And then three, what does any of this have to do with my life? So what's going on? What about El Olam? And three, what's this got to do with me? I promise you, ewes and lambs, Philistines and wells have a lot to say about your life. So we're going to begin with question one. What is going on in this story? And I'm going to walk you through. I just gave you a quick overview. The main point is that Abraham makes a treaty with Abimelech, who is a local king. And this allows him to permanently settle in the new territory. But this is actually only a fraction of what is really going on. To fully understand this story about cows and lambs and wells and Philistines, you've got to understand two other stories. If you don't know the two other stories, all of this just looks like a weird sermon to preach on. The two stories involve Abraham, story one, and the second is about Canaan in general, and that's we'll get to that in a second. But Abraham, first of all, who was this guy? The story of Abraham matters for understanding this text. Who in the world is Abraham? So Abraham was an ordinary man who'd been called on by God to leave his ordinary life. God had a specific plan in mind for Abraham, specific plan, but the first step for Abraham achieving this plan was to step away from the things that made him comfortable. He was from a region where his parents had been from, his grandparents had been from. He knew home and home knew him. And the first thing he had to do was step away. And he had to step away not knowing where he was going or how he'd get there. There was no GPS. And he'd not been given the directions. He didn't know where he was going. After God spoke to Abraham, he left his hometown and began to follow the prompting of God, even though God didn't tell him exactly where he was going just yet, or even how he would get there. Now, the turning point of this journey of Abraham's life actually occurs in Genesis 12. People who teach Bible like I do for a living, Genesis 12 is one of the most important passages in the Bible because this details the call of Abraham. Essentially, God calls out Abraham and says, listen, you've left your home. Now I can use you. Note that the sacrifice, the risk, preceded the promise. Abraham said yes without knowing where. He jumped without knowing where, and he went. God shows up a little while later in chapter 12, and he says, listen, I have a plan for you. I'm going to use you, and here's what it's going to entail. Now, to give you a sense of what's going on in the broader picture with Abraham in Genesis 12, you might have heard about the Garden of Eden. If you're not Adam and Eve, first humans living there, they were made and created to represent God in creation, to represent his interests, etc. So they were there to watch over so we had that planned, huh? We'll get it keyed. Tired of repping, decide that they would like to be the switching.
We got there? Okay, great. All right, so in case you lost me for that little long bit, the case is this. Adam and Eve were made to be representatives of God, okay? And they decided they didn't like repping someone else. They wanted to rep themselves. That's essentially what the story of the fruit is and them taking it. They got sick of being someone else's representatives, and they wanted to be in control. Most of you, actually all of you, know exactly what that feels like. You want to own things. You want to be the shot caller. And that's what Adam and Eve, the story, is about. Now, because they decided they didn't want to represent God's interests, the Garden of Eden is God's. Therefore, they were fired from their job. They were sent from the Garden of Eden eastward out into the wilderness. But that was never meant to be permanent. The Bible says from that day forward, God was about the business of bringing humans back to the garden. Did you know that history is headed for a garden? History is headed to us going back to reclaim our rightful place as God's representatives. And he is not going to stop. He's relentless in making that happen. In Genesis 12, we get the first glimpse of how that will happen. God will use individuals and communities to bless the entire world and bring back not just a man and a woman, but all men and all women. That's the story of Abraham, and then later the story of Jesus. And that's where we're heading in creation. That is Biblical Theology 101 right there. We've hit it all. In Genesis 12, God gives the first glimpse of how this is going to happen. And what he says is this: Abraham, I'm going to bless you. I'm going to promise you four things. The four things are these: land, blessing,
name and nation. I think two people in here that have taken my Bible class know that I talk about this a fair bit. But the four things that he promises are land, blessing, name, and nation. Quickly, what that means. Land is a place to be. It's a home base out of which Abraham will bless the world. That's land. Blessing. This can't just be empty land. This will be abundant land. In the same way that God created dry land out of water, out of the seas, he then filled it, if you notice. God doesn't leave deserts. He's about the business of filling things. So this dry land will be abundant, or this land that Abraham gets will be abundant, and that is the blessing. The third thing is name. And this is another way of saying meaning or prominence. If you've ever seen the, I can't believe I'm about to reference this show, but The Wire, it's an old show about the drug trade in Baltimore, Maryland. One of the characters wants his sole goal in life is to have his name ring out. He wants on every corner his name to ring out in the city. That's what he lives for. And actually, I say that advisedly because I think most of us, we want our names to ring out too. And that's why we work hard to leave things behind for other people. That's why we want to be known. That's why athletes and actresses and actors go about all the pain they go through to try to have fame and fortune. But a name is another way of saying prominence or meaning. And God says to Abraham, you'll get that. And then finally, a nation. People to follow him in all this. It'd be one thing if Abraham had land, blessing, name, and then died, right? Nice little day in the sun. But no, God says, I'm going to make your blessing last, and I'm going to give you descendants who will become a nation who will go about the business of transforming the world. Now, one major point to keep in mind in all this, and this gets lost a lot of times, this was never about God singling out a special person because he was cooler or better or smarter or wiser or prettier. Neither does he do that today. God does not have a cool kids table in the cafeteria of heaven. If you've been told otherwise, I'm sorry, and none of you would be at it anyway, and neither would I. Thankfully, there's no such thing. God chooses people not for the purposes of making them feel special, but you're always chosen, always picked for the sake of blessing the world, of bringing back the entire world to the garden. Men and women to their places as rightful representatives of God. It's always for the sake of someone else. And that is what is going on with Abraham. The gift of land, nation, blessing, and name. Well, these were the means by which God would bring all of humanity back to Eden. And Abraham would be the first agent of this. The Apostle Paul actually says that you are Abraham's descendants. So in other words, it's now your job to bring about the blessing that God has in mind. But that is another sermon for another day. So that's the story of Abraham, a man on a mission. Story one, you need to know a little bit about Abraham and what he was about. Story two is actually about Canaan, about the place Abraham traveled to. Now, this is the kind of thing you won't probably know by just reading your daily Bible reading. This is, we're entering into nerd territory. I just want to warn you. Fortunately, today you have a professional nerd, a professor, who's here to kind of let you in on a little bit here that's going on behind the text. This story is important. Abraham settled, talks about here, near Beersheba. Beersheba is actually in the south of what we call the Negev, which is a borderland. It's actually the southern region of the current area of where Israel is today. It's an area that's big into agriculture. Okay, there are places in the west where you can farm, but as you go even a little bit from the coast, you start to head east, it's really just good for pasture. It's a lot of open land, and then you hit into desert land. So this is an area in the south where there's a little bit of farming, a lot of shepherding, a lot of herds and flocks and things, but the point being, this is an agricultural area. We're not going to, you don't need to know much about all that other than to say this. The people there were not known for their IT skills, nor were they a manufacturing area, or they didn't make steel or anything like that. These were farmers and shepherds. Now, all of agriculture, and I know I am preaching to the choir here, well, it's dependent on weather. All you need to do is take a quick drive around Pendleton and see some of our new lakes that are preventing corn from being grown to realize weather messes with agriculture. And as we've seen already this year, the weather is one of the few things that we as humans have not quite figured out how to control, and it bothers us, doesn't it? Sometimes weather makes for bad harvests, but sometimes it can be plain terrifying. When the tornado hit last month, many of us went outside and watched like idiots. But only because we could retreat at a moment's notice back into our well-built homes or curl up in a ball in a bathtub, whatever we needed to do. But if the tornado came closer, we could get inside. What if you lived in a tent? Where do you run? The folks I was with got texts. Each of us got text messages telling us a tornado was coming. I don't know how much more convenient it can get from the modern standpoint. We couldn't believe it. Of course, that's what made us walk outside, but that's another story. But the Canaanites had no such things. They were at the complete mercy of the weather. For us, that's hard to get our minds around because it doesn't really matter. Even on a day like yesterday that was incredibly hot, most of us could go inside and turn up the air. And the weather didn't mess us up too much. It's something that's just so different in their culture. Their biggest threat, the thing that prevented them from eating but also terrified them and kept them up at night, was the chaos of weather. And weather, as you know, is fleeting and unpredictable, especially if you don't have phones equipped for text messaging. They didn't even have phones, no flip phones. They couldn't get texts saying the weather was coming. They couldn't actually look and see a radar. When the storm arrived, the storm arrived. This was a very precarious time. So these people, and this is the important thing, these Canaanites, these early Philistines, they needed a God who was predictable because nature was not. It's no surprise then that the head god, and we know this from archaeology, the head god of the Canaanites in this region was called El Olam, the everlasting one. Say that again. Prior to Abraham ever arriving on the scene, everyone in the neighborhood worshipped a god called El Olam, the everlasting one. They wanted something lasting in the midst of their chaos. This is fascinating to me and should not be missed. Before Abraham arrived, Abimelech and the Canaanites had their own everlasting God. Given what you now know, you should be starting to get a glimpse of what's going on. The answers to questions one, what's going on here, and questions two, what about El Olam, they should be coming into focus. What's going on? Well, this. Two major stories are converging at Bathsheba. The Canaanites have their story of a God who has always been and always will be an everlasting God, one who makes his own claims about being in charge of the present, the past, and the future. But Abraham had a promise from another El Olam. He has encountered the living God, and this living God has promised him a permanent future. And this God has led him to this place in this moment. The story that Sam read really is fundamentally about the faithfulness of God. The God, the only God, who ruled in the past and who holds the future. Only this God can be trusted to keep his promises because it is only this God who owns the future. So in our story for today, we're seeing this God, this living God, this God of Abraham, El Olam, we're seeing this God begin to deliver on the promises to Abraham. Remember in Genesis 12, I told you that Abraham had been promised land and blessing and name and nation. Well, the promise was real, but up until now, Abraham has not seen, he hasn't even sniffed seen a glimpse of this promise coming to fruition. He actually waited 25 years. That is a long time to wait for a promise to come together. It has literally been decades since the promises in chapter 12. Each year, Abraham and his wife Sarah got older. And each year, the promise looked less and less and less likely. You know, Sarah actually laughed when an angel told her that God would still send her a son. She said, "I'm old." And she laughed. It wasn't a fun laugh. It was a bitter laugh, a laugh of someone who had lost it all and who knew that life was really a joke. But El Olam is faithful. After 25 years of waiting, God finally started to deliver on the promises. I just want to take a second here. Many of you have been living in the gap between the promise and the blessing. And if you're honest, you've begun to question the faithfulness of God. But oftentimes, the promise precedes the payoff. Oftentimes, the promise precedes the payoff. That's the way it works. We have an example of this right here. Abraham waited 25 years until he saw signs that God was serious, that it wasn't just the result, this promise, this fourfold promise of a good meal and maybe a nice night that Abraham was having. He's like, you know what? I think God's telling me I'm going to hit it rich. No, this was God's promise. It just took 25 years to materialize. The life of faith, let's say this, the life of faith is lived between the promise and the payoff. I wish I could tell you otherwise. If that's you today, you're in good company. Abraham, for instance, is your company. So back to that guy. In our story and in the chapter right before it, God is finally starting to deliver on his earlier promises. Now, in the previous chapter, chapter 20, Isaac is born to Abraham and Sarah. They finally get the baby boy. After years of waiting for a son to carry the promise into the future, God provided Isaac. Now, this is a fascinating irony that we don't see. You know that God has a sense of humor, and we don't just say that because it's actually true. The Bible's got some interesting stuff. Do you know the name Isaac literally means he laughs? And some biblical scholars I read say that the best way to translate it is God laughs. So Sarah laughed at life when she was told she'd have a baby, and she laughed bitterly, and it was a joke. In the end, God laughed and said, you thought this, I got you. That's what Isaac means. God laughs. And he laughs at most of you and me. So the birth of Isaac represented the first down payment on the promise for Abraham. This was the promise of a nation, and the birth of Isaac was the down payment, the first deposit into the bank account of a nation that would grow and grow, and of which you are a part, by the way. Who would have thought? Could you have told Abraham that someday in a beautiful land, the land of Pendleton, there would be a group of people who represent his nation, when he couldn't even have a son? God came through. But that is one of the blessings. There were three to go. So maybe this is, can you really bank on that? That's what Abraham's thinking. Well, in chapter 21, the others start to come together. In our story, God actually provides the down payments for two more of the promises. This is an important text, name and land. Let me go into this a bit. Name, remember I talked about that as meaning, having your name ring out, significance, prominence. Well, note that in chapter 21, verse 22, Abimelech says this, if we could get that up there. God is with you in everything you do, Abraham. Now swear to me here before God that you will not deal falsely with me or my children or my descendants. Show to me in this country where you now reside as a foreigner the same kindness I have shown you. The presence of God in his life has given Abraham a name. Abimelech, a foreign king, recognizes the hand of God on Abraham. And he says to him, you have meaning, prominence, and I recognize you, so much so that I'd love for you to occupy this valley. Go ahead, pick any land you want. One down with nation. Second down with name. He's starting to get recognition. Keep in mind, Abraham was a wandering foreigner with no claim to anything. He goes, it's a typical rags to riches tale, maybe the first ever, but he goes from being a nobody to having the local king recognize him as a man who is close to God and who has power. That's an important thing. So you have, with Isaac, you have nation. With Abimelech, you get the name, and then there's the land. The well of Beersheba in this story, well, that's a big deal. Now, most of us have never lived in a desert. Some of you may have. I'd actually never have. I've lived in Florida, which is the opposite of a desert, except that it's incredibly hot, but it never, you don't breathe air in Florida, you drink it. Yeah, I was just there this week. It's unbelievable. But near a desert, there's only one way to survive, and that's if you'd have water. When you're on the edge of a desert, like Abraham, the only way to have any kind of lasting presence, and remember, that's what the gift of land is about, having a home base from which to bless others. The only way for that to happen is if you have a lasting water source. If you do not have a well, you migrate, you move, you travel, you have to go to follow the water. You're always moving your herds. You are open ranging it. But with a well, you can put down roots. But you cannot put down roots without water. Nowadays, the first step to putting down roots is signing your name on a lease or a mortgage, as you know, okay? Back then, the first way you went about putting down roots was to dig a well. That's just the way it worked. So digging a well isn't just about having a drink. This is a sign that we read in Scripture to say this is Abraham's gateway into staying someplace. This is his first chance of being permanent. By securing a permanent well, Abraham has truly arrived in the land. But he doesn't just arrive and tentatively start like unpacking, you know, opening up his tent and like unrolling his carpets and just saying like, hey guys, maybe don't bring out the dishes just yet. We're not sure we're staying. No, he puts a well and then he says, you know what? I'm staying put. And we know that. And that's the whole thing with the tree. Now, everywhere else that Abraham meets God and it has an encounter with God, he builds an altar. Do you know that this is the one place in the Bible where he plants a tree? Now, a tamarisk tree, for those of you that aren't horticulturalists, a tamarisk tree is really an important thing in arid areas, especially in the south of Israel. These are big trees that can grow up to 30 feet tall. There's a lot that could be said about these, but the biggest point is this. You plant them near wells to offer shade for you and your family while your herds do their drinking. If you have a tamarisk tree, you have some degree of comfort, but if you know anything about trees, they do not grow overnight. When you plant a tree, you're committing to the future. When you plant a tree, you're committing to the future. So Abraham is essentially telling his neighbors in planting this tree, listen, I'm staying for a while. You better get used to me. You might have heard of me. Abimelech has. I'm staying put. This is home now. And I think this is important. The tree planting is Abraham leaning into God's promise. Remember, he got a taste. God has said, in essence, you're going to have land. And so far, he hasn't had any. He's had to wander. There have been all kinds of awful battles and things. He finally gets there. And the only shred of evidence he has that God's fulfilling his promise is a well. But that's enough for Abraham. He plants his tree and says, I'm here because God's promised. He got a taste of God delivering. And by planting a tree, Abraham goes all in. Which brings us to Abraham calling God El Olam. By calling God El Olam here, the everlasting God, Abraham is doing two important things. First, he's honoring God for the fact that God has been faithful. He isn't just the God of the good times. He has been with Abraham through every step, the hard ones, the good ones. Even in the waiting, God has been there. Abraham is expressing his deep faith to God when he calls on El Olam. He's essentially declaring that he will continue to be true to his word all the way until the end of time. That's what Abraham's doing by calling God El Olam. Again, the first time in the Bible that this is used. The second thing I think is more profound for us. Abraham is challenging, by calling God El Olam, Abraham is essentially challenging the status quo of the culture that he moves into. He's essentially saying this, I know you know an El Olam, I've heard about your worship to him, but there's a new El Olam in town, and this place ain't got room for the both of them. This is a direct challenge to the surrounding culture and one that's powerful. You see, these Canaanites had a need for a God who was everlasting, a God who could exist beyond the trials of everyday life, a God that would exist past the weather, a God who could make sense in the long term. Do you know, this isn't in my notes, but as late as 1515, the life expectancy of a human in the West is somewhere around 35 years. If you had a baby in 1515, you had a coin flip chance of holding that child, I'm sorry, of celebrating that child's 8th birthday. A coin flip. If you had a toothache, you had a toothache for life. And by the way, bad eyesight is not just a thing today. It's something that went back. There are people who lived in 1515. This is the area I specialize in, a historian. I apologize. But there are people who lived in 1515 who never saw a leaf on a tree. They saw blurry green objects without corrective lenses. One historian has said that life was brutish, cruel, and short. That's 1515. Go back 3,000 years. How do you think they were doing? When you live in a culture like that, where you're susceptible to everything the weather throws at you, and you've got a toothache for life, and there's no medicine, and you can't see leaves, you're in trouble. You want a God who's beyond all that. Keep in mind, too, an old person's 40 sometimes. I mean, you do get examples in the Bible of older people, but the idea is it's fleeting, and you want to hold on. So to have an everlasting God is important. Abraham is saying, your everlasting God can never deliver. He couldn't deliver. He's not real. And in fact, his time is over. The future belongs to Yahweh, the true El Olam. Which brings us to the payoff. Question 3, what's this got to do with you people and me? Can a story about an ancient treaty at a well have any meaning for our lives? And the answer is an emphatic yes, as strange as that might seem. I want to make a couple observations as we close. The first is this. Here we go. We live in a culture that has some pretty good, well, I shouldn't say good, but some pretty loud and pretty compelling stories about what will last and about promises. Our culture makes promises to us that it cannot keep. I apologize beforehand if I step on toes, but mine needs stepped on here, so here we go. Our culture tells us that happiness comes through success. That money or career or even family will meet the deepest longings of your heart and will put off the inevitable, which is your death, the fact that you will lose in the end. It tells us that those things, money, career, family, that they offer a fulfilling, lasting, everlasting perhaps, future. That if you just get things a little bit righter, the chaos of life will fade and your future will be sweet. Essentially, what our culture is promising us is really little morsels of everlasting life, and we chase it. Is it real, though? Does it last? You might not think I'm serious. Do you know that last year the cosmetics industry worldwide brought in $523 billion? If you listen to sports talk radio like I do, you might have noticed a proliferation and an increase in the number of commercials targeted at my demographic, at people who are getting a little older, and it's offering you whatever treatment you can to maintain the youth and vitality and vigor of your life. You can have more testosterone and that will solve your problems. It's offering you something that's more lasting. One of those is actually called, and think critically, one of these is actually called ageless male, El Olam. Ageless, everlasting. We are being sold, just like Abraham's culture was, a bill of goods. The truth is, our culture is exactly like the one Abraham encountered. It is selling us cheap versions of everlasting life, and we're buying it, even though we all know deep down that it doesn't last. The best we can hope to do is put off wrinkles for another few years, or keep those testosterone levels high, well, for just a little bit longer. But it's putting off the inevitable. It doesn't last. In the midst of this, though, God offers his own promises. He is the real El Olam, the everlasting, the author of the past and the holder of the future. Throughout the Old Testament, people give God names. It's no accident that when he finally tells a human his real name, though, and this is to Moses in Exodus, what does he say that name is? He says, my name is I Am. Not I was or I will be, I am. It's a present tense verb, which is to say that in the past I was or I am, in the middle I am, in the present, and in the future I am and will be. The promises of our culture won't last. They will fade. there is no everlasting life apart from the one who is at his core, and hear me say this, isness. I tell my students this as often as I can, but God is about the business of isness. He is. Everything that is in him. That's what the Bible says. I am, that's what I am means. Literally on God's business card, he gets up in the morning, has his coffee, and gets about being. He says, I'm about the business of isness. That's what he does. That's his tagline. That's who he is. And he is eternally there. The eternally I am. The eternal I am. I am essentially means that God is about the business of isness. One final application from our passage. Some of you, like me, have had your fill of promises, but have simply not seen any signs that God will be faithful to deliver. And this is a hard place to be, no doubt. But this story, well, it's offered me some encouragement, and I want to pass that along to you. Abraham waited 25 years before he got a glimpse of what God would actually do, of the fact that God would come through on the things that he has promised. God is El Olam. To you, I want to say that. To me, I want to say that. He is the faithful one. He is the one that lasts. If that's you right now, I want to challenge you to do something. When you pray this week, if you're in that position, why not do like Abraham and call God El Olam? By doing so, you are reminding yourself of the things he's brought you through, and you're saying to the Lord, I know that when everything else fades away, even through the darkness, when the darkness passes, because it will, when it does, God will be standing. Pray to God as El Olam. The second thing is this. What would it look like for you to plant your own tamarisk tree? What would it look like right in the middle of your culture, right in the middle of your pain, right in the middle of watching all of these other options present themselves for a lasting kind of life? When you see people who have hurt you living the good life, when you see people who have done you wrong succeeding, when everything around you makes it look like God actually isn't the one who will last, plant your tree then and stay for a while. Because those people, those evils, those trials will pass. And you'll have some shade to sit in when they do. Plant that tree as a token of your belief that God can be trusted to provide, that you're staying here and putting down roots, even on the edge of the desert. Would you stand and pray with me?